Yesterday I was talking about the simpler cases of like the scalar wave equation on Schwarzschild, but now we have to face the real problem, which is gravitational waves on a truncated Kerr background. Truncated Kerr, for those who aren't here, is just an approximation to these type of objects I was talking about yesterday. But I was showing it's not a bad approximation. The gravitational waves are complex amplitudes. And as with most of these analyses, we focus on the one that's apparently dominant, the 2-2 mode. So we can factor off the angular dependence and focus on this complex function of time. And so how do we get that? Well, we don't get that directly. We get another quantity, psi omega, quantity in frequency space, which happens to be a solution to one of these equations. And I'm using this Sasaki-Nakamura equation, which gives some function psi omega nx. If we take the large x limit, we get what we want, which is the psi omega. We've been hearing about boundary conditions, but maybe more important is the initial condition on this problem. So I'm just, because I thought I didn't have much time, I'm not going to say much about this, but.
You can. You might have to surprise me with extra time.
So there's some amplitudes, so that we can talk about the frequency content of a pulse. So that's the simplest picture. You start off the problem with a pulse, and I'm talking about a pulse on the inside of this potential barrier that we all talked about, the angular momentum potential barrier. You start with a pulse there, it's traveling either inwards or outwards, and it has a frequency content. So that's given by this amplitude phi omega, f of omega. And this such that it's related to what you could call a spectral flux density. So in that sense, it's related to something more physical. And so then we can talk about things that give more sensible looking flux densities. This is frequencies, both positive and negative, and a spin of 2/3. So we have a super radiance region in this region of frequencies. And in that region, this quantity actually goes negative. So we have to decide what's a reasonable choice for this frequency content of this pulse. And so if you didn't know anything else, we might say, well, the modes that are more likely to be excited are the lowest energy modes, or in this case, even the most negative energy modes. So this blue curve then is what I'm going to use for this f of omega. And it's centered, the Gaussian centered around the middle of that super radiance region. Okay, so that's just a simple idea, assuming we didn't know anything else. But as we heard yesterday, problems are being solved where we do know exactly what's going on, like a small mass orbiting in and generating the perturbation that you want to study. But in this case, we've got two roughly equal mass black holes, and they finally collide, and we really don't have much idea what's going on there. But I think in your case, you would have a peak maybe over here a bit, closer to the
closer down to the super radium boundary.
Oh, right on the boundary?
Sorry?
Or so there's that boundary, but there's also the ring gun frequency, which is usually a little higher than that.
It's because here you are, I'm not entirely sure if you're, I multiplied the frequency content of the initial pulse times the transfer function. Here, after you multiply the peak, it's after the super radiant bound frequency, it's closer to the ring down, precisely because what I was saying about the transmissivity, having a zero at the super radiant bound frequency, so it suppressed the signal from at that point.
So it looks like that Luis had a big peak at drain down, but you had a small peak where yours is, right? So you have two peaks, like, and it's zero at the super radius frequency exactly, but has like a small peak at the peak.
And of course, this depends on the mode we're looking at. And you have studied another mode, M-2?
No, M2.
But you had a particle going in the other way.
Now, that was in a previous paper that I did the scalar case.
That's the one I'm thinking about.
Okay.
And in that case, you had a bump down here somewhere.
Yes, but that's because you are rotating against a black hole, so you can have excitation of negative frequencies would, in the care case, related with the -2 mode. So that's what can happen.
Right. Okay, so I'm just going to jump right to the answer for psi omega and the absolute value of this. And this is the simplest case, just one pulse that moves back and forth. So this is a simple case that does give echoes. And so we see that zero at omega zero, which is that spin related special frequency. And that you mentioned that zero too.
Yes.
But there's this negative frequency structure, which even though that Gaussian was nuts, was centered on positive frequency, in the whole, like you said, there's a transfer function and a source integral. The source integral actually has factors that tend to enhance the negative frequency.
The source term?
But this is what we find. The same reason there's a zero here. So there's actually just a factor of absolute value of omega minus omega zero. So the further away you get from that, the more enhanced you get. So that's one reason why this is as large as it is.
So what does negative frequency mean in that case? I'm used to it in the discrete case. But here, that's a continuum. What does it mean here?
I'm always doing discrete calculations, so.
So there would be very high frequencies then?
No, okay, let's go back to the beginning. We have a complex amplitude. So if you're taking a Fourier transform of a complex amplitude, you need to look at the negative frequencies as well as the positive frequencies.
Yes.
Right? So that's all I mean.
You mean physically what the negative frequencies mean?
Oh, yeah, no, they travel in the other direction.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, go on. Sorry, guys.
It's just, if you had a real waveform, then you don't have to talk about negative. They're related.
Oh, yes, that is just the factor of who that you're getting. Yes.
By the polarization of,
really, it has to describe the two polarizations. Anyway, so it's because of this three bump structure that the echoes you get out of this thing, even in the simplest case of a single pulse, I showed last time a blow up of these echoes, and they're very irregular. So it's one reason why an echo search is not as easy as you might hope.
These waveforms, did you measure them at infinity, far away, getting out of them? Or where did you measure them?
Measure what?
The waveform that you're, is this something that's transmitted out of the box and going to infinity? Or?
Yeah, this is the time waveform.
At what distance, I guess?
What distance?
Did you pick one point?
Oh, yeah. So
in the potential pit, or?
Well, I said I took the x equal to infinity limit of that equation.
So okay, yes.
Some large x, numerically.
I think another question is, did you look at the strain, or did you look at just the Sasaki Nakamura variable? Because that could make it.
Yes, and I'm going to mention that.
Okay.
Mention it. But yeah, there is a difference. And I started off with an H of T, so I mean the strain there. Psi omega is not just the Fourier transform. And it's related to this SM formalism, so there's this factor called C0, which relates to two. So I take that into account when I get the strain. But okay, here's a non-simple case. So like I said, well, after the merger, the initial condition may be quite complicated. We've got this cavity formed, and in the cavity, what is the perturbation? And if it's complicated, then it's not just a simple pulse that travels back and forth and generates echoes. It could be a complicated perturbation throughout the cavity, and that does not generate echoes. So since I have this thing set up to do pulses, I can put in 100 random pulses as modeling something complicated. And the resonance structure is still there. It's just modulated in a non-trivial way.
Have you looked at the positions of the peaks? They are the same?
Yeah. Whereas the echo structure is completely gone.
So these random pulses, they should decay at different time scales.
These are just the initial conditions.
I was thinking with frequency space now. Should the different frequencies decay at different time scales? And you then define something like quasi normal modes with different decay time scales.
That's all taken into account by solving the SN equation.
Yes, but if you do that analysis, then it might mean that of this noise there, some decays rather quickly. So if you wait 2 or 3 echo time scales, some of them might be more prominent.
Yeah, the lower frequency. No, actually, they're all quite similar with resonances. That seemed to be a property of the Kerr case. In the Schwarzschild case, it turned out that the widths were decreasing as you came down.
Well, what I see is that this actually depends on where you put the boundary condition, not if it's Kerr or Schwarzschild, just if you put compact or not. This would change the place of your peaks and also the width. Thinking about quasi-normal modes, for instance, just in regular Kerr black hole, depending on the spin, they would become more width because they are getting closer to the real frequency line. So it can depend on only one parameter. In this case, the compacticity of the object. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, there's some frequency dependence of the widths and the heights. Everything is frequency dependent.
But no, depending on the compacity.
How big the cavity is. Well, how big the cavity is just tells you how many of these spikes you have. So you see here that I've chosen quite a large cavity, and so I get many resonance. Delta T is large, delta F is small.
No, but what I mean is about the width of the...
The width of each resonance?
Yes.
Yeah, well, as you see, they're all very narrow.
And even if you change the compacity?
Yeah, you're right. I think there is some dependence there, but I focused on the more realistic case. Like, Niash has a very precise prediction for what this cavity is, the size. So we're not interested in small cavities.
But I mean, I think the other part of it is it really depends on your reflectivity assumption. For example, if it's a constant reflectivity, that's one thing. If it's frequency dependent, or like for Boltzmann reflectivity, then you get a constant ratio of imaginary to real part of the quasi-normal mode. But then if you have constant reflectivity, I think it's different. I don't remember. Maybe they'll become more and more long-lived. I can't quite tell right now.
But
it depends on your model.
Yeah. So there's one other thing, going back to this complex versus real waveform. Because LIGO strain data is just a bunch of real numbers. So depending on how the detector is oriented, it projects out the two polarizations into one. And just gives us real numbers. So we have to do that too because we want to figure out what to actually look for. And we model that just by taking the real part of this complex H of T. So now we can start to think how we're going to look for resonance. And we're doing it in frequency space. So we take their data for some time range, including some number of echoes and E. Then we take the fast forward transform and take the absolute value. So basically, then we have a quantity that we can look for resonances in. But we have to do it for the real part. So taking the real part, following these steps, then gives us something we can follow as something, a spectrum that we can actually look for. But it's going to be modified by...
Why do you get only the real part, sorry?
Because this is what a detector does.
Real part in real time, of course, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the reason you get a complex, I mean, originally this is complex because you have H plus plus I H cross, but of course, the detector just sees one of those polarizations, you don't see both of them.
Yeah. So that adds a little more structure to the final spectrum. So here's an example. I'm considering these large number of echoes because that seems to be where the signal shows up. Some spin, some mass, and this delta T, which is related to the cavity size, and that dimensionless number is large. That's even somewhat smaller than what Niash likes. Maybe this is a little bigger than that.
Which dimensionless number? That one.
Okay, so then there's this two-component structure, which I think you can just see here. There's this, it's like two components superimposed on each other, and you can see this lower one. And this lower one is due to the negative frequency part that's been flipped over by taking this real projection. So then it's important, the relative size of that negative frequency part and the positive frequency part, because this thing can go up or down depending on what happens. And the other thing is, it kind of lines up here, but that need not be the case. So these two components may actually be shifted to each other. And that has to do with the boundary condition too. So yeah, other searches typically model the flow waveform. And in frequency space, that would include the phase information. And that's a big mess. So I guess since I'm from particle physics, we don't worry about messes like that. We just want to know where the resonances are. Right? So we just we look at the absolute value of this frequency-dependent function. So I've got this object in frequency space involving some duration of time from their data. Then I do some more things. So first of all, band pass, F min and F max. That'll be a data-driven band pass. Then I take this object of data and multiply by a comb. So that's the basic idea of trying to pick out a spectrum. It's evenly spaced, so that's the crucial thing. You see an evenly spaced spectrum, then you try to take advantage of it. And that means you can use a comb with evenly spaced teeth. And so that comb has a spacing between the teeth, that's the delta F, and an overall shift. So then we invent some kind of correlation that looks for some enhancement of what you get out of all this, or some common value of spacing and shift.
So how do you pick F min and F max?
Well, okay, let me just go on. Okay. So this is, in detail, the quantity that I call a correlation between the two detectors. And I don't think I'll go through these details, but they're all here. So everything's well defined, and you want to try to reproduce what I'm doing. Okay. So at this stage, this correlation is still a function of the spacing delta F, because I've taken a maximum over the shift at this point. So then this, then I can plot C as a function of delta F, and that's what I call a signal plot. So, okay, so here's an example of a signal plot. So what set of spacings do I use on a signal plot? Well, I'll use a discrete set of spacings determined by an integer defined in this way. So it's delta f over the basic unit of frequency, which is 1 over total time. So I set a set of spacings, which is given by an integer on this axis. So that's a function of n now, and I'm just looking for a peak. I can arrange for the peak to sit right at a particular number of echoes, in this case 200. And I then tune delta t. So delta t is the inverse of delta f, the spacing. And because we've got a large number of spikes, we have to tune delta f very precisely. Because if it's off a little bit, then that comb will be off eventually. Tries to capture more and more of these spikes.
So you're trying to match something in frequency space, something regular.
Yes.
So naively, I would say you do a Fourier transform to find that. And then, of course, the Fourier transform of a Fourier transform, essentially, you're looking again for a peak in position space. So how is that different from what LIGO does originally? I mean, where does the echo stuff come in? Did I miss something in my head?
Well, you're taking the Fourier transform back into the time domain.
Yes, I mean, if you're looking for a comb structure, then that's essentially what you're doing. But then you were just looking for one peak, and that's obviously not what you're doing. So I must have missing something.
Well, as I said, the echo structure, which is what you're talking about now, may or may not be there. So you're superimposing all these modes in frequency space, and you get something that could be echoes or not. So I'm saying the time domain is not a place to be.
But I mean, I think the point that Eric is making is that if you're taking basically the power spectrum and you're looking for repeating spikes in it, right? But then one way to find that is looking at Fourier transforming the power spectrum.
Oh, but if you do the Fourier transform of the power spectrum, then I have the absolute value squared in there, which is something non-linear.
Then it becomes the correlation function, in fact. No, it is a thing, right? So I think the Fourier transform of the power spectrum is a 2-point correlation function of the real-time correlation function.
Yeah, but it's very different from the original signal. That's the point I was missing. Thank you.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it still is something you could, I mean, yeah, that's an option. You could look at a 2-point correlation function.
Yeah. Or maybe some kind of autocorrelation function in frequency space.
Sure. But I think if you just do just the autocorrelation function, if you do the Fourier transform of the power spectrum, then you get the 2-point correlation function in real time. If you do something else, then that's the other.
So that turns out to be the case. I find these peaks. I can find some peak, and then when I tune delta, peak gets larger. And I'm just saying that's kind of expected. Okay, now going back to your question of what determines the bandpass, well, in addition to tuning delta t, I have these other quantities to vary, which include the bandpass. And the choice of NE, which goes back to the choice of the how long duration of data did you choose to begin with. So yeah, so that's why I mean F and F max are data driven. And on a plot like this, it's the yellow band. And I'm superimposing the actual spectrum given values of these measured quantities. So we can compare the two. So I'll go through each event and we'll see how that works out.
Sorry, you are choosing a particular initial condition here, right? In this,
yes, that's right. This spectrum is going back to the simplest one, one pulse on the inside.
So why this particular one?
Well, I showed the other example, the other extreme, where it was random, and you got you would get similar looking, but the it's modulated in some complicated way.
Because my first guess would be to use not. If you are claiming that your initial condition can be really complicated and you don't have a good intuition of the initial condition, I would use some model agnostic thing that only shows me independent quantities. That would be the transfer function. And I would only look for spikes and excess in power spectrum of these frequencies.
Well, then you're saying that all modes of any energy are all being excited equally. And I don't think that's a reasonable thing.
No, I would look for excess, power excess in each one of those frequencies and see if this power excess is there or not. If those, I will be only answering the question if they are excited or not. And the relative excitations I can trace back afterwards or something, but at least it's independent of the initial condition.
These two numbers are basically doing what you're saying. This is my way to let the data tell me where the highest spikes are.
Well, but you are assuming a specific...
No, this is data-driven. This has nothing to do with the red curve.
The red curve is just an example. It doesn't go anywhere in the analysis. The red curve is a sample. But so how do you get F min and F max then? You said it's data-driven, so...
Maximizes P.
Oh, okay. So you go... For some of the events or for each event?
Each event, I do this search for that peak.
Okay, so for different events, you have different
events. Okay. And the other thing I've done recently is then try to get some idea of the relative size of this background noise for the two detectors and the size you need of this spectrum to actually generate a peak that you see on the signal plot. And I can do that by taking this H of T from this spectrum and injecting it into the data or some noise data, the LIGO noise data. And then just redo the analysis. And then I can roughly see what the normalization of this spectrum is. And I can even rewrite it as a peak of the strain, the theoretical strain, which would be the peak of the first echo. And so you get some number like that. And so that's the first echo, the first pulse, which is corresponding to more like the ring down. On this plot, it's this small black function. So this is really showing that because we've got a model here with many echoes before they finally die away, they're dying away all the time, but slowly. That you're getting what looks like a lot of power or square root of power in these spikes. Now going back to that signal plot, away from the delta T, where the spike sits, is a lot of noise. So we should try to determine the distribution of those background correlations. So I can generate many background versions of the signal plot by just moving the segment of data away from the signal region. And I'll end up finding a PDF for the distribution of those background values. Another thing that's good reason for doing this is that in each of those background plots, I can look right at the signal position and hope that there's no excess correlation at that signal position. If it was there, then you'd say, well, there's background generating this thing away from the signal region. And so I don't find that. So that's a good check. I don't find that excess correlation, except is one exception, which I can come back to later. Anyway, this PDF here is a so-called generalized gamma of that form. So it has this exponential falloff. But still, by the time you get out to where the signal value was on that example, it's a tiny part of the PDF.
So you get a p-value out of this, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Okay. So this is after struggling with p-values in our first paper, this at least is a little more systematic way of doing it.
But assuming that that fitting function is a good one.
Yeah, well, the histogram is just there to show how well it fits. But the actual fitting is done through a maximal activity.
But I think the main thing is the tail.
That's
just
right.
About
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this is typically to calculate p-value, you have to calculate lots of background values there. And I don't want to go beyond 20,000. So. I think I'll just skip this. So let's just look at the various events. So the first, these two plots you've already seen. So this is the first event. And so for every event, I got a delta F that's determined quite precisely. I got this dimensionless ratio. And one of three spins, that previous slide was saying, I'm just going to assume one of three spins for each event.
You know what that is in seconds? That's in classes.
Yeah, so this is about 0.25. You get 0.29. So all, yeah, all my delta t's are
a little bit less
than yours.
So what are your values looking? 2.9 and 2.5?
0.25 seconds.
Okay. So what we found was 0.29 seconds, and what we found is 0.25 for the time between echoes.
For the same data.
But it's the same, but yeah. I guess the question is there an error?
No, no, I'm saying this is very precise.
Yeah. You want to say something?
But do you guys understand why that they're different?
But I mean, I just hear this. It's a bit too soon.
I guess another way of asking is, you know that if you're both right, you know
you're
both
right.
So it's not like your errors are that big that you could be, right? So it could be somebody's wrong.
I mean, there could be some sort of a resonance thing in principle, because you have like 200 echoes and we have 10 echoes. So yeah, so I mean, in principle, you could imagine, I have no idea why.
But you haven't even looked in this region.
Yeah, I know we haven't. I mean, the region of, yeah, there could be a bigger peak there, right? Actually, this thing that Jahad was, yeah, I don't think he has looked for it. I don't think he has. But I think the problem with looking at repeating patterns is that you could also find resonances of that. Even if you're not looking in that region, you might find some resonance of it, some rational number times that. So there could be some consistency, right? You see what I'm saying? No, I'm just saying that if you have, say, 12 elevens of your thing, or some rational number times your thing is like, so we can still find it, not quite as strongly as you do it, even if your thing is real. Or vice versa, maybe our thing is more real when you're finding a resonance.
No, but it would be good if you looked over a wider range, or
yeah,
at least this range.
Right.
Then we could.
And what is the p-value that you find?
Get to the p-value.
Oh, okay. But keep the surprise in the classic. Okay.
So we can go through each event. And so this is a very weak event. Weak signal. The signal's down the bigger part of the. This event has its own story, which I can talk about later. So yeah, each event has a different mass, and the mass, or the inverse of the mass, determines the range of frequencies. So each event is probing a completely different range of frequencies, and the data-driven bandpass is coming out in a way that's quite consistent with these very different spectra in each event.
So my question is that when you compute this PDF for the histogram, for every background sample, do you recompute f min and f max, or you just fix f min and f max to whatever you got from the min?
It's totally from that signal plot. It's data driven, and this has nothing to do. This is non-signal stuff. That
but the question is the parameters.
Oh yeah, yeah. To generate this, I do assume that then.
Okay, so that's the one thing that is a bit worrisome, is that you want to do exactly the same thing you do with the main signal. You want to do the same thing with noise, including finding the best f min and f max and right now you find them for the main signal, but then fix them when you do the background. Right.
So if I wanted to repeat the whole analysis,
so the whole thing is going to shift up a little bit because you're going to up,
So yeah, if you're doing the search in noise, then this bandpass will be some random place, right?
Yeah.
And so then you have to account for the fact that those random bandpasses are not consistent with the theoretical prediction.
But then either you get it from theoretical prediction or you get it from data. You cannot have the false rates, right?
No, I'm trying to do what you said. Well, let's just repeat the whole analysis where I don't have a theoretical prediction. But at the end of the day, you have to account for the fact that then there's a probability that the background will generate something that is consistent with. I mean, this data-driven bandpass, I've got 10 events. In each case, the bandpass is fairly consistent with the spectrum.
Okay.
And if I generate 10 random ones, they're going to be random all over the place. And you have to then figure out the probability of those random bandpasses all lined up properly. So that would give you a very small probability.
I guess it's something we should talk more about.
No, I thought about what you're saying.
But I mean, the thing is, this a posteriori statistics is that you choose a statistics based on the data.
I guess another way of saying this, not only is there evidence against the background here, but there's evidence for the signal.
Right.
And if you're doing it your way, you have to take that into account as well. Yeah, so basically, the strength of the signal you can easily see.
That's the very strong one.
Yeah, this is one of the strongest ones.
As is that. Is it relatively consistent with ours here? Yeah.
I don't know. This is always.
Always. Okay.
Smaller than this.
But anyway.
Going through 9 events. Getting to this event, this is the most interesting event. So this is an event with a mass and spin quite a bit larger than any of the others. And what happens if I get two signals in this event, or it's two different band passes, and they're both strong signals. And they both give almost exactly the same delta F. And the other, well, then you can ask, why don't I just choose a bandpass that covers the whole range, just one bandpass? Well, then the signal goes away. And but can't you see why that could happen? Because of what I mentioned before. This is the negative frequency part of the original signal. It may be shifted once you start to this part. So that would explain why single band pass cannot work. So the cone wouldn't line up both at the same time. So this event is giving evidence for that kind of shift. The other events were kind of the opposite, that you get a better signal if the things do line up. So I can only have one band pass. So I get conflicting results for what this shift is doing in the various events. But anyway, this event really helped to make me feel a lot better about what I'm claiming might be a real signal. And then this is your event.
It's the bad, yeah, our body moves.
And your first 10 spikes are down here. And you say, well, I'm way up in the region where the noise is largest. Yeah. But this is a linear scale, so.
And it depends, of course, if your signal goes right about the noise, then. I mean, I guess one thing worries me that LIGO actually searched for a signal there and those frequencies, but they didn't find anything.
They searched for what signal?
They searched for post-merger signals at high frequencies. But that's the random frequency you expect from, like, binary merger
or for the ring jones?
Yeah, right. I mean, I guess it's not, whatever, I guess it's a mess there. I mean, you have two versions instead of merge. But I mean, they didn't look for resonances. So this is just a factor of twice what we find, right?
You're getting 144.
Wow, okay. Yeah, so that could be
plus or minus,
not quite.
Plus or minus one or something. So yeah. It's just a little.
Just a little bit up.
But your result also indicates that this model I'm using is off in some way because you're getting real big strength down here. So, which could be true. Like I said, I only have this 1-2-2 mode, and you're talking about other possible modes.
That could be different modes, yeah.
And the other thing is, in some of my cases, there's this bump here, but my results would be even better if this bump was somehow larger. So.
But then, I mean, the Boltzmann reflectivity would help with that. Because that would kill the one we do, I think.
Yeah, but I still need strength down here. This bandpass is always probing this region, which is way within the super radiance region. How much time do you want me to go on?
Well, I think an hour for lunch would be probably not too bad.
So I just want to get to the key values. And this stuff you've seen, at least some of you have seen this before. So this is this dimensionless ratio. I mean, everyone's seen this formula. For the current case, what this ratio is in terms of these quantities that are all measured by LIGO, the redshift and the spin and the mass. And depending on where you think the deviation from the Schwarzschild metric is as you come in, I phrase it in terms of this eta. So eta equal to 2 would be your choice. And yeah, here I give the relation between eta and this delta r in terms of either the proper Planck length, which is tiny, very tiny, and the ordinary Planck length. So then there's this plot which has been out for a long time now, showing that these events are consistent in this way as well.
But this hasn't changed, this plot?
No, this plot's the same. So this is another thing, that if you were just generating a bunch of stuff from noise, you would then have to fold into what you get, that what's the probability of all these things lining up? So there's some evidence here for a signal on top of just building up noise. And here I was just showing the effect of that formula, so the redshift and the spin dependence. If you take that away, then all these points go above 2, which is not reasonable because then you're smaller than a proper Planck height. And this one event that I've already said is the most interesting, goes way up. So already we see the spin and redshift acting to bring that down, be consistent. And now, finally, the p-values, well, you know how I'm getting them. I have these p-values now, and the p-value is related to this part of the integral. But that's just for one measurement, for one particular choice of delta t, for example. So what range of delta t's am I going to allow to look over to generate possible fake signals? Well, given that plot I just showed you, one thing to do is just say, well, let all these possible choices for delta t lie within maybe a 2-sigma band on that plot, so bigger than the one I showed. So I take a band like that, and that has about 25 points in it. So I take this small area, multiply by 25, and so I'm calling that a simple p-value. So here are my p-values. So this is your main event. It's your very strong event. So it is. Anyway, it's one of the smaller ones, but this event blows everything away. Two values like that. Okay, then the question is, what do you do with a bunch of independent p-values?
This one is the minor neutron star. You don't have the
one. No, I don't have that one on because I don't know. I don't know what they actually. I can't use that formula because they don't tell us what the mass is. So how do you combine p-values? In your papers and others, you use something that corresponds to taking the square of the signal-to-noise ratios.
Yeah, we sum them.
Yeah.
But that's not combining p-values. That's combining signals. It's combining values.
Then you could convert back into Anyway, there are these two well-known, or one less well-known. Fisher is a common technique in particle physics to combine p-values. And then there's the Stouffer method, which looks more like what you're doing. You take the p-values, convert it into something more like signal-to-noise, and you combine it there, and then you go back again. Okay, so doing either of those methods, you get this tiny combined p-value. And now, going back to your question, so you've got these PDFs, and you say, well, maybe I'm not modeling those tails very well. Well, what if I just added 0.005 to every one of these p-values? And so I would think that would more than enough account for what you're worrying about. So even in that case, they'll get quite small. That's it.
Your mic drop.
Okay, thank you.
This is like 8 sigma or something. Have you tried converting it to sigma yet?
5 sigma is?
8 to the minus 6 is, I think, is 5 sigma. So I guess that the minus 10 11 should be probably 8 sigma.
Yeah, so this sounds very dramatic, though.
So what do the experimentalists say? I mean, you guys probably said this yesterday, but why are they not?
They have no interest.
Why not? Interest.
They're. Well, you ask them. I can't explain it. Well, they haven't seen this p-value, so
yeah.
They've seen the earlier stuff, and they're not interested.
But the program is that you're basically taking their data, you're searching for a peak, and you're optimizing how to make the peak as high as possible. And you do that separately for each different event. Because it sounds like that, you know, so is there a look elsewhere kind of number there? That because that's a dangerous thing to do, right?
Exactly. That's what.
Do you think you're doing, you got that right? Yeah.
I've got something called, you could call it a simple p-value, which is, I think, it captures how I am getting a feel for the data. So, you know, as you do these things, you get an idea how probable something is, because you look for it and you don't see it in background, and something shows up and you see how rare that is. So intrinsically, you get a feeling for what you're seeing. The question is, how do you use p-values to translate that feeling? And these p-values, I think, do represent how I'm feeling about the data.
I think,
and if I didn't feel good about the data, I wouldn't be presenting this no matter what the p-value said, because right. of things you're saying.
Right.
P-values you can mess around with and get whatever you like. But what I think what I did is fairly reasonable. And so
likewise, templates where they look for that they use for matching. Did you try to do the same thing for a template? Because the template is constructed, there's not going to be an echo there.
Well, that's what I talked about yesterday and today. These echo templates are trying to model the full waveform. And there's just way too much information in the full waveform.
Because if we don't...
You take data that has been created from a template. You create LIGO noise without a signal
put
an numerical relativity template there, and then you repeat it, and then what p-value do you get for your signal?
I put in my template, my model, the red spectrum. I get the strain H of T from that, inject that into the data, redo all my analysis, and look for a spike. And depending on the amplitude of what I put in, I can get a spike that looks very similar to what I'm finding. So that gave me the normalization of my red spectra on the plots.
I don't think I understood your question. I'm not sure whether.
No, I know.
Yeah. So what is your question?
Okay. You said numerical relativity. Well, there's no numerical relativity for echoes, right?
Yes, exactly. That's the point.
So that you don't know what to
do. You're looking for an echo in a case where there is no echo. So what kind of echo would you find?
Yeah. I mean, just like looking at noise, is that what you're saying?
No, a signal.
A main event. If you just look at the GR prediction for binary black hole manager, you don't say, okay, I don't look for echo, it's just a
yes.
Yeah, I don't know. You could try your method.
Well, you need something. Can't use black holes, you have to use a modified black hole in their code, and that hasn't been done yet.
I think what Eric is suggesting is that take the numerical relativity waveforms and use your method to find echoes in that.
Oh, yeah. Find echoes or find the find the inspired waveform?
Well, whatever, just use your method, your template or your comb on the numerical relativity waveforms.
I wouldn't find anything. Why would I find?
There would be
frequencies. You have the numerical waveform plus noise, so you would find something.
Yeah.
You would find something, probably. Yeah.
My whole thing is geared to find these evenly spaced sharp resonances.
Exactly.
And anything you're talking about have never generated such a thing. Sharp, evenly spaced resonances numbering around 50 or 80. Has not occurred in any numerical relativity code.
Exactly.
Ever.
Yes. Yes.
So
yes.
Why would I find anything if I looked at such a thing?
because there might be a flaw in the argument, or a flaw in the calculation, or a flaw in the implementation of the program. The point is,
why don't you say I should just do it on noise data? Yeah. Repeat the analysis many times on noise data. Well, that's what these p values are trying to ask.
I think maybe, but Eric is right that maybe you're catching part of the main event. Is that right? Is that what you're worried about? Is that you're not actually looking at post-merger stuff, you're looking at somehow your template is, like your method is picking things that part of GR. But I mean, is that a concern? Are you sure that what you're looking at is post-merger?
I always start away from the ring down.
Okay. So you don't have to use any data from them.
Right. Are there questions? That's pretty dramatic. I mean, I think the only thing that could be, I mean, if I can poke a hole in it, the question is, I mean, how much a posteriori statistics there is. That is, I mean, these parameters, that, I mean, there aren't too many parameters here. So, I don't know.
That's kind of the main feature of what I'm talking about is trying to reduce the number of parameters.
I think the next thing to do, you'd certainly sell it better to the experimentalists if you agreed with each other, right? That's, that sounds like that would be.
No, exactly. That's one reason that they don't listen to us at all. Yeah. They don't agree.
Right.
And I don't think that situation is going to change.
Sorry, you don't like, who does it? The two of us don't agree.
We don't agree on the delta keys.
Right. Yeah.
So that pretty much kills their interest.
It's not like some redshift factor.
But I think the one obvious thing, it could be just the result, but I'm not sure exactly. I mean, it's going to be close, but not close enough. It's just that we just looked for Planck scale echoes. We didn't really look for things that were at a different scale. So it could be that we just find some resonance of what you're finding, and yours is much stronger than what we. So it could be. I'm not saying that yours is wrong. I'm just saying we just didn't look.
Well, maybe you should look at it.
Yeah.
Because that's something that sociologically would help persuade them to
up to, right?
Right.
No, but like, there's kind of an advantage for them not to be lucky.
Temporarily, yeah, but eventually you want them to look, right? So that,
yeah. As long as we live long enough, we'll find out. But by that time, we'll have done everything.
Yeah. So your job is to do that and then live well so you survive. Yeah. And then, yeah. But eventually, there.
That's right. So I think the next step for us is just to need my hands to die.
If you
want to
be ambitious, you should go into some finance. Generate a lot of money, donate it to LIGO in order to do detector development and increase sensitivity, thus.
I think if you make a lot of money, then we're done. Okay, well, I think with that conclusion, maybe we should just thank Bob again.